Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Diana Scrafton joins us from Trash Hawfield, looking at the new Sainsbury's that's proposed. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square, or on 0117 989 7733, and I'll repeat that number at the end of the show. So first, Diana Scrafton from Trash Hawfield. First of all, Trash Hawfield, what does it stand for, Diana?
Hello, Tony. Trash Hawfield, it stands for Traders and Residents Against Sainsbury's Hawfield.
Now, most of the residents, I'd imagine, are actually probably for it because people rather like supermarkets, don't they?
No, I'm afraid that's not the case. And certainly in our area, there's an awful lot of opposition to this possible supermarket. I mean, it's been planning permission has been given to it, and it's supposed to be built on the memorial ground. This is a wonderful heritage site, a World War One war memorial. Obviously, it's a football stadium at the moment, and it's owned by Rovers, Bristol Rovers.
Now, I can't quite understand, though, why residents are against this, because it means it could be incredibly convenient, literally walking to the end of the street to get to a big supermarket rather than having to drive further or, you know, walk a bit further and then only get to a small shop, maybe on the Gloucester Road.
Oh, there are lots of reasons why people have objected to this, and a major one is that it's very close to the Gloucester Road, which is, you know, one of Britain's longest, if not the longest, high street full of independent shops, and the thought of a gigantic Sainsbury's there, and this is going to be a very large superstore, it's very threatening. Now, we've had a judicial review, which we brought against the council's decision to give planning permission earlier in the year, but that was actually overruled by the judge in the case.
But I mean, just a minute, because you know, a lot of people go to a supermarket, but a lot of people go to a rugby stadium, football ground, the memorial ground as well, don't they? I mean, it's not surely going to increase the numbers of people going backwards and forwards. And what are the main objections of residents like yourself?
It's because it seems to be a totally inappropriate development on that site for many reasons. It's a site that's very well established in the community. It's in a very residential area. The entrance to the site is on an unclassified road. It's close to the Gloucester Road, as I've just said. We have lots of supermarkets in Bristol, and we have a plethora of them with an easy reach of this particular site. I mean, within a 3-mile radius of the site, you're looking at some 14 supermarkets of different sizes. But there's a lot of opportunity there if you want to go and buy in a supermarket to get your purchases there.
But we live in a free country, don't we, supposedly? You know, the idea is that if Sainsbury's have got their eye on a super spot for one of their supermarkets, that they should be able to buy the land and just build where they want.
This is a free country, and, you know, as residents and traders locally, we're taking a stand against this because we do not feel that it is a good idea. The supermarkets have an awful lot of power. They really do have a lot of sway over suppliers, as we all know. And they do suck out a lot of money from the city as well. It's not as if it's like the independent shops where the money keeps circulating within the city. We're looking at millions of pounds actually being sucked out of the city each year.
Now, I've heard about this for years now. It seems it's been going on and on, this possible Sainsbury's. Has the land actually been sold by Bristol Rovers to Sainsbury's? Has it actually changed hands yet?
No, it hasn't. And there is something of a question mark over that at the moment. As I understand it, and as has been given out in the media, there is a contract, a significant contract between Sainsbury's and Bristol Rovers, and that is to do with the sale of the land so that they can build their superstore, which will provide enough money for Rovers then to be able to move out to South Gloucestershire and build on land currently owned by UWE, and to have a collaborative venture with UWE. So there's quite a lot tied up in this, but Sainsbury certainly have been talking with Rovers for a while, and they do have a contract and they have permission to build there.
They've now got their planning permission, haven't they? How much money then, let's talk cash, you know, readies. How much cash have Rovers made out of this sale? Do we know?
I'm not too sure. We were talking about 30 million, sorry, initially, but I understand that the figure is probably more like £20 million.
Okay, so the land hasn't actually been sold yet. So what stage is it at? They've got their planning permission. Why haven't they sold the land? Do we know?
Well, something's been sticking, and I mean, we as residents locally have been watching this very carefully over the summer, ever since the judicial review didn't succeed, to see what has happened. And of course, there's an awful lot that has happened, including Rovers being relegated to the Conference League.
Oh, that's right. Yes, their actual performance has been appalling, hasn't it? As a football club.
Yes. And I mean, the fan base obviously is just you know, hugely disappointed and really worried about what the setup is. I mean, they've been doing all right in the Conference, but it is the Conference League rather than playing at the, you know, one of the divisions. As I understand it, Rovers have been showing reluctance about committing to this contract ever since last November, that is November 2013. And ironically, that's about the time when the Trash Horfield campaign was taking off, and we were awaiting the judgment of the first judge as to whether we actually had a case to take to judicial review. So at this time, when we were still waiting this, and to be honest, the media was really slamming us and hoisting us high, and a lot of venom was coming out, you know, towards the people in the community who were taking a stand against this possible development.
Well, hang on a minute, because you are the people who have actually got to live with it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't think that's really fair. It's all very well for people across the city to say that's not, you know, but I mean, you guys, you're just down the road from the new place, and so yeah. You're going to have to live with it, you know, into the next decades or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not somewhere that you might just visit as a Sainsbury's or not visit. But look, is it true? Because I've heard rumours that Rovers are actually suing Sainsbury's, so perhaps that's why these contracts not been exchanged yet.
Well, yes, we know that a writ has already been sent out. I mean, this is because of delays in getting this contract up and running.
I can imagine if I was Rover's boss, I'd be thinking, where's my cash? Where's my readies? We've got the planning permission for you.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, and it's been holding them up, and I understand that it's increased their costs quite a lot. And I think this writ is for some £340,000. So there is a legal, you know, procedure being taken at the moment. But I think if Sainsbury's do pull out of the thing completely, as I understand it, Rovers will be suing them for doing so.
Crikey, again. Well, what about, okay, so the latest is the new planning application. So they've managed to get their original planning application, but now they've said, well, I'll tell you what, this is Sainsbury's we're talking about here. I'll tell you what, we're going to put in another planning application, and I imagine that they will be wanting a little bit more.
Yeah, this is a specific issue, and it just it's part of the original planning application permit. Sainsbury's have always wanted to have much longer delivery hours for their lorries. I mean, really, what they want is a 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Oh, God, because that could mean great big lorries rumbling down these little roads at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and
precisely,
people being woken up by their beds shaking as they come past. And, you know, this doesn't sound really appropriate, possibly for an industrial estate or something. No one's going to mind too much, but down these little residential streets. So what are they asking for?
And this is exactly the issue. They are asking for 19 hours out of every 24 hours. So from 5 o'clock in the morning until midnight, which would allow people on the routes of these HGVs, and obviously who have their buildings, their houses around the memorial ground where the development will be, just 5 hours of quiet, peace and quiet. So 5 o'clock, that would be actually when the lorries are already at the supermarket and starting to unload. And if you trace back from that and they're coming up from, say, the M32 up the Muller Road or from the M5 down the Gloucester Road, they will be travelling along those roads, along homes and houses, you know, for households with families and all ages there. Maybe 4:30 in the morning?
The planning system, I mean, this is something which I suppose most of, including me, we look at the planning system, we think this is some incredibly complex world that's actually rather dull, that we don't want to get to understand. But I guess you have had to get your head around it, because this is supposed to be where people like you can put your objections into plans like this.
Yes, that's right, Tony. And I mean, this is another big issue, because it is very complicated, and it takes a lot of time to really get in and understand what is necessary. You're allowed to make objections. These are, you know, invited, and there's information up there on the websites, but you still have to be able to move around on Bristol City Council's big website and get to the points and really take them in and make sense of them. And this particular planning application, it has got a lot of plans and drawings attached to it. Luckily, you know, there are people who are objecting who have great skills and are able to understand these things. But I would say one thing. I mean, this is open to objection by everybody, but it's no good when people don't know about it. This was brought out in August. Emails went out to a certain number of people, by no means all the people, but I understand that the guide was the number of people that had made the original objections when this planning application went in January of this year and was subsequently refused by Bristol City Council.
Okay, so that's for this new one. Surely everybody should be consulted, the whole local area.
Yeah, we feel
You know, have they done this thing, which the planning system, this weird, peculiar workings of that? Sometimes what they do is they put notices up on lampposts and things like that. That's quite a good way, isn't it, of just letting everybody know that a planning application's in.
Yeah, no, there hasn't been any of that. Emails have gone out to some of the people who objected previously, and I think some letters have gone out. But, I mean, we ourselves, as a campaigning group and with information coming from the community, know that many people have not received them when they should have done. So, in fact, there's been another 3 weeks allocated to those people who haven't been communicated with, who really should have been, so that the, you know, decision as to whether it'll go to a planning committee or whether it can be done sort of internally within the planning department has been postponed by another 3 weeks.
So you've done some written objections over mm-hmm. the last couple of years to this. You've been doing your judicial review. But have you actually ever been to a planning committee meeting? Because that's surely where the final decision is made, yes or no, about whether an application is going to go through. That's the democratic process, apparently, where you get the elected councillors mm-hmm. sit around mm-hmm. and make a decision.
Yes, and there were a lot of people who had put in objections, who went and sat in the council house on the original committee, which was on the 16th of January in 2013, when the planning committee actually decided to let this thing go through as part of an enabling scheme to ensure that Bristol Rovers would get their stadium. And, you know, a lot of very good points, a lot of very strong points and are well articulated, were put across. But to be honest, you know, there was a lot that we felt was very wrong with that committee meeting, the way it was conducted and things which got said and things which didn't get said.
OK, so look, just untangle this complicated planning system for us mm-hmm. a little bit, because you've been there. It's almost, I feel like, you know, you've been to almost a hell and back, you know, somewhere which most people really don't want to go there. So what did you learn from that whole process of having to put objections in at the planning committee and how things really work?
Well, you need to be able to use the kind of jargon that is accepted by the planning department. I mean, in a way, that's kind of appropriate because we all have to be speaking a similar language so that we can understand each other. But it's very complicated for the layman to actually come in and be able to understand what will carry weight and what won't carry weight. And that's actually applying to this current planning application at the moment, because we're looking at the whole issue of noise and people's sleep and the amenity of the place, the amenity of local residents. I mean, the very word amenity, you know, you have to go to the national planning policy sort of framework and understand, look at the texts that the government have published, to then look at the planning guidance that goes along with that, and then understand what Bristol City Council, how they're interpreting it, to be able to get anywhere with it.
But so you're having to go up against essentially, you know, some expert barristers, lawyers who are paid a fortune by Sainsbury's. How have you fared in that little battle?
Well, at the judicial review, you know, we we didn't fare very well. In the end, you know, everything got our case got rejected. Although we had some very top lawyers who put over some very good arguments, but the judge came in. You know, we had been told to expect 2.5 days of like close, you know, discussion and listening to a lot of information. And right from the start, you know, the judge said, "Oh, look, a lot of people here. We don't want this to go on for 2.5 days. I want to get it done within the first day. So if you can all just, you know, speed up and go through it quickly, we'll do that. And then people won't have to come back for the second day or the third day." Well, we knew from that point that something was, you know, not...
Well, hang on. I mean, this is a rugby analogy, isn't it? Those goalposts have shifted. Suddenly, first of all, you're being told it's going to be a three-day hearing, and then you're being told no. As you step in there, suddenly everything's going to be... Yes. Settled much more quickly, and you're not going to have the time to put forward your arguments.
Yes, that's
a
right.
bit naughty of the of the judge.
I think so. And you know, one of the things which our barrister had asked for was to be able to cross-examine people within the planning department about information, but that was ruled out.
Really? Mm. Gosh, that's awful, because surely you should be able to... I mean, if you're doing a judicial review and you're questioning some of the decisions of these planning officers, that's part and parcel of justice, at least it should be. Now, look, the ground itself is called the Memorial Ground.
Yes.
We mentioned this briefly a little while ago, but isn't that just a name? Is it in any way really any kind of memorial for the First World War?
Oh, it's a wonderful memorial for the First World War. And I would highly recommend that people, you know, get onto the most recent website, which Jamie Carstairs, local historian, has put up there, because it's got some fabulous photos. And it really does show how that memorial ground came into existence and the kind of goodwill and the you know, determination to sort of commemorate the contribution that all those sportsmen, soldiers from Bristol made in helping to win, you know, the war and keep things better for people in Britain. But it was land donated by the man who set up the building company Cowlin, and his name was Mr. Cowlin, and he donated a large area of land specifically for the rugby club to be able to develop, and thousands of pounds were then collected from within the community in Bristol so that the stadium could be erected. And they had to do a lot of work. You can see these in the photographs where, you know, men are digging, great amounts of earth had to be moved, and the grounds were levelled, and a wonderful provision was made, and then the stadium were actually put up around that. But it's wonderful to see, because the photographs really do show how very full it used to be, the attendance by people, not just in the community, but they would come from far and wide. And there was a major sort of kick-off game between Cardiff and Bristol, which really got everything going. But it was the home for Bristol rugby for 93 years.
Amazing. I mean, I would have thought that the Bristol Rugby Club, who I believe own the actual land still, don't they? Or what's the ownership? So what happened? How did it get into the hands of Rovers?
Well, apparently during a time of low income and financial distress on the part of the rugby club, Rovers, having set up some agreement with them earlier on where they were sharing the site, I think bought them out.
Okay.
It was very controversial, and I think there have been a lot of questions asked about it. But, you know, it was obviously a sad day for the rugby club and for the community.
But it says something, doesn't it, about the original setting it up as a genuine memorial to the First World War for yes. Bristol sports people that yes. had fought in the First World War. Let's just leave aside the rights and wrongs of the First World War for a minute, because, you know, there's lots of questions about that being brought up 100 years on. And people really objecting to certain government ministers and things, saying, oh, it was a just war and it had to be fought. A lot of people saying, no, you know, it was basically a family squabble amongst these cousins from Russia and Germany and Britain, who they were the three leaders of the three countries. Basically, it was a family squabble, you know, that that killed millions of people and achieved absolutely nothing. So there's that side of it. But I mean, the fact that you've got so many photos from the original setting up of the memorial ground does suggest that there was some genuine community feeling about it. Most places, when they're built, you know, you don't get people taking lots of photographs of them. So they're clearly the local people really cared about the place.
Yes, I think that's absolutely the case. And and I think, you know, the spirit of commemoration was sort of all pervasive throughout the country, really. Other memorial grounds certainly were set up. But, I mean, this one represents Bristol's kind of largest and, I reckon, most significant war memorial. And they want to put a blooming supermarket on it.
I mean, surely Sainsbury's are, you know, mindful of that and want to keep something preserved of the World War One memorial status of the site.
Well, they are now, because a number of us went up to their AGM in July and we made sure that they heard about it. And to be honest, that the hall pretty well erupted when Jamie Carstairs was able to actually speak about that at the AGM and say that, you know, it really was not appropriate for Sainsbury's to be building on this site.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. So you went to the Sainsbury's AGM?
Yes.
And were given a chance to talk about it. What was the reaction?
I mean, did you
get reactions from the directors of Sainsbury's?
Well, it's the usual kind of, well, we don't know about all the sort of local detail, but, you know, we're listening kind of thing. But we didn't get very much. It was interesting, though, that so many of the shareholders there, you know, applauded very loudly at what was said.
I mean, that's why I suppose they go along to the shareholders' meetings. It's actually participate in the run. They don't want the Sainsbury's brand, the reputation, to be tainted, do they? Also, one thing that strikes me about all this is that our Mayor, George Ferguson, is supposed to be sort of for the little guy and quite against supermarkets. Have you found him any support in your campaign?
No. We haven't, to be quite honest. He's been very pro supporting the Rovers in getting their stadium. And while we can understand that, we feel that, you know, all our concerns, which we've been voicing pretty loudly, have just fallen on deaf ears. And that's right up to the mayor and including the mayor. It's very disappointing, really, because we know that he's been very outspoken about his dislike of supermarkets. He really does feel that they do not contribute to the sort of general health of the sort of grocery markets, and he would much rather see a lot more local produce being produced.
Now, look, just a minute, because this is surely a perfect chance for him to, for George Ferguson, and I'm sure, George, if you're listening, you know, Surely you can say something about this one specific incident, because, you know, there's so many people either on the Gloucester Road, which is famous apparently across the country as a nice little high street, and also the local residents, that you could actually say something about this. Because ultimately, what we hear is, anyway, is that George has the final say on everything in the city now.
that's absolutely right. I think we do hear that.
So why don't you think he has? Because, I mean, I can remember, you know, certainly in the months leading up to his election as mayor, that he made a big thing of this, that, you know, I'm against the big multinationals and I'm for the little people.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think one of the reasons is that there's been, you know, very high level, very prominent arguments being put forward by MPs, particularly Charlotte Leslie, about this whole development and how important it is, you know, for Bristol, in as much as it'll bring in, I don't know, millions of money to help facilitate sort of transport developments and such like. And, you know, Charlotte has taken it three times to the Prime Minister and has encouraged him to get involved, and he has spoken out at Question Time, Prime Minister's Question Time, about it. So it's been very high profile. And George, being the mayor, obviously, you know, this is a difficult position.
Yes, it is, isn't it? So what stage are we at now then? When do you think the land will change hands, and when are we going to start to see a Sainsbury's being built? Because it certainly does look as if, you know, we're nearly there, aren't we?
If we have anything to do with it, it's never going to happen. We would really, what we want to see is a really appropriate development there, but perhaps we can talk about that in a moment. But this current planning application is to raise these delivery hours to something that would be acceptable in the first instance to Sainsbury's. Obviously, to get in, they'll probably be wanting their 24 hours, you know, within the first year. But, you know, we're going to fight against this because it really is inappropriate. And we have put in a huge number of objections. We've got double amount of objections to the number of people that have written in a support. Can you believe it? Actually, there are a lot of people that support the idea of these lorries going on, you know, residential roads at 5 o'clock in the morning and being able to deliver right up until midnight. But, you know, and a lot of these applications, and also a lot of these support comments have come in from people well outside of Bristol. I think there have been something like 80 or maybe even 90 of these support things, and some 20 of them actually come from people within Bristol. But they're coming from, you know, as far away as Macclesfield and Linlithgow.
I mean, surely they're not admissible, are they? Because these people have got no interest in whether or not there's a Sainsbury's at Horfield. I'm wondering whether this is the planning consultants working for Sainsbury's. I mean, I've seen this before where they're paid X amount of money to get letters of support from anywhere, and then those letters of support are being encouraged by a planning consultancy, nothing to do with the actual wishes of the person that's sending them.
I've heard such things as well. I mean, I can't comment on that, but it does seem to be very, very surprising and really rather shocking. And we are hoping very much that this planning department will just not pay any attention to them.
Excellent. Well, we'll see. Yeah, you know, it does seem ridiculous.
We will see.
People from so many, you know, miles away could actually have a say in it. It seems
it's
bizarre.
It's not just the delivery lorries at that hour either. What is being proposed is the putting up of very large walls around the backs of all those premises which actually back onto the site where the Sainsbury's will be built. And we're talking about noise barriers, they're being called. And these things, I mean, in one place, they are reaching 3.6 metres. I mean, you're talking about 12 feet. It's extraordinary,
so
really.
So that's basically being built at the end of someone's garden, is it?
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah.
And for these things to be, you know, more effective, they have to be sort of continuous, although I understand there are a good number of breaks in them, which obviously will lessen their effectiveness. But the noise assessments also, the way it's been done this time, we have a lot of complaints about that. Various things haven't been taken into account. And, you know, there's a lot of detail that's not being provided, you know, including a plan, a delivery plan by Sainsbury's. The number of lorries, we still do not know how many they are looking at during the 19 hours that they're proposing. And this kind of detail we should know. We don't know. We know that they can probably accommodate two an hour. But are we looking at, you know, two every hour coming up the Muller Road or along Gloucester Road, down onto Filton Avenue? There's two junctions, you know, the one at the top of Muller Road and then the Filton Avenue Muller Road junction. I mean, neither of these are very large junctions, but they're going to have to cope with lorries, articulated HGVs, which are up to the weight of 44 tonnes. And then they're going to come on this unclassified road and turn in to the site. They're apparently building a raised platform roundabout there, which is especially to accommodate these large vehicles. It's going to have a sort of soundproof top to it, I think. But that hasn't even been included in the noise assessment. And we think that, you know, that's another detail that's missing. We're not at all happy about the way it's being conducted. So, you know, you can see, Tony, there are an awful lot of questions.
There are, certainly, and it'd be interesting to see if they're listened to, some of these, you know, quite serious objections. But you said you'd like to see other things going on with the site.
Yeah.
Yes. It's difficult because it looks as if you know the those that want the money from the site have decided that they're going to have it, and so you're fighting that kind of the plans that they've made and the wishful thinking that they have of having that cash in their hand. But what would you like to see happen there?
Yeah, a lot of good ideas have come, you know, forth from the community. I mean, obviously the economics of it is the key issue, but we know that we're short of housing in Bristol, and I think there's quite a feeling that a good amount of housing could go up there, but there's a great will to try and protect the memorial ground or something of the memorial ground and keep the spirit of it there with which it was built in the first place, which is, you know, to have a place where sport can be played and maintain, you know, activity there, which is a commemoration of the sportsmen soldiers who died in the First World War, and that was really what the people who set up the memorial ground in the first place, that was their main objective, and it, as we understand it, that, you know, the grounds were put into the hands of trustees, and it was for in perpetuity, so that the whole thing would carry on and be a source of inspiration to future generations of Bristolians.
Amazing. So anyway, tell us a bit about what you're doing to campaign. You mentioned that you're sending in objections to this latest planning application, but I thought 6 months or so ago that Trash Hawfield was finished, the planning application was there, and that was it, was cut and dried. But I'm interested to hear that it's not. So tell us what you're up to these days.
Yeah. Well, we've certainly been campaigning around this particular issue. And, you know, this does mean making sure that people know about what's going on and what's going to happen in their area is so vitally important. And we get so angry because, you know, we live in a democracy, and yet we really do wonder, you know, it's become very ragged at the edges, this democracy that we live in. And I think there are a lot of people. It's very interesting to see what's happened in Scotland recently, because, I mean, what a great model for the rest of us, getting involved, really getting down to grips with, you know, into grips with it and discussing, you know, what is important for the future and this kind of thing. And I think, you know, locally we need to be doing that as well, a lot more. But democracy to me means that people who are going to be affected by a new development need to be informed, need to have the opportunity to understand what is being, you know, put up for development, and the chance to ask questions and really get to grips with it and to have their voices heard. That's not really. That's not happening.
Okay, so for Trash Hawfield, do you have regular meetings? And how do people get involved if they want to take part in this sort of almost resurrected campaign? Because I think, I don't know what your thoughts were, but I certainly thought everything was finished once they got their planning application.
No, by no means. I mean, it's we've still been very active right throughout, because there's been so much going on. I mean, we were hugely disappointed and really felt, you know, quite low initially, when we found that we were unable to go to appeal on the thing. I mean, we would have had to have raised another £30,000 probably to have done that. And we knew that it was stacked up against us. You know, going to appeal is even more difficult than actually getting the JR in your favour in the first place. So
That's a judicial review, yeah?
Yeah, the JR, yes, sorry, judicial review. We have watched, since July, we have watched an appeal being put in, having been sorted by Rovers, and then Sainsbury's were asked to sign it, to try and get the planning inspector to do a turnaround on the original decision about these 19 hours. That was followed by a planning application, which just concerned the delivery hours, followed by another planning application, which kind of superseded the first one, which then brought out the whole business about, you know, having noise barriers put up around the backs of these houses. So there's been a lot going on. And because we never know, really, we just have to keep our ears to the ground. This is, you know, where I think the democracy is falling down. I mean, the planning department, we're able to speak with them and we get as much information as we can do. And that's, you know, that's fine. But the whole process is very laborious. It's time consuming. And, you know, people are working, and this is all on top of everything. Yes, we do have regular meetings, and we very much welcome support from everybody. I mean, anybody that has concerns about the build of another supermarket, particularly in that part of town, and, you know, on a war memorial, you know, we welcome them. Give us your support. We'd really help.
I want to get back to this issue about George Ferguson, though, because I'm really annoyed and disappointed that he's sort of sided with the big guys, with Sainsbury's on this one, and seems to be so behind it.
Yes.
having said really the opposite in his original campaign. And I wonder whether he's still really at heart a merchant venturer, because, of course, he was part of this elite group that many say owns the city, really, rather than is apparent in its political shenanigans, that they own vast areas of land, and they have a fantastic amount of money which they invest. In fact, they're all, the merchants are doing very well out of all this government austerity, because most of this quantitative easing money, the printed money, the QE money, is going into their share investments and their asset prices, that kind of thing. The merchant venturers are sitting there rubbing their hands while people are queuing up at food banks. And also there's the fact that when George resigned from the merchant venturers, when he became mayor and he was elected mayor, he still meets with the merchant venturers, of course, because he is mayor, and the merchant venturers wouldn't want to have one of their nice dinners without the mayor there. So I wonder whether he's really part of this kind of city elite which has been going for hundreds of years.
I've heard it voiced by very many people, to be honest. I mean, I'm not in a position to comment, but I think, you know, it's a very uncomfortable position for all of us that are involved in sort of campaigning against it, knowing the amount of power that there is sort of stacked up against us.
Well, I walked past their headquarters of the Merchant Venturers a couple of weekends ago up on the promenade, right next to the Downs, of course, which they own, and, you know, beautifully kept. But, you know, you think, well, these people really do have some money, don't they? Maybe they could be thinking about helping out some of those in Bristol that have nothing, literally no food. And going past the gates, they have their crest, the crest of the Merchant Venturers on the outside, which is all in Latin. And a few years ago, I actually got a Latin dictionary and translated what it means. And it means in English is, the poor are stupid and will suffer much.
yes. Well, now, what can I say?
That is particularly nasty when you start thinking about the merchants' role in the slave trade and the vast amount of money they made from shipping slaves over from Africa over to the New World. And so there's something a little bit patronising about the whole merchant venturer. Well, we're just a little group of reasonably well-off people, and we do like to do reasonably well, and we're here as a charitable institution. Well, they seem to be very charitable for themselves, and I just wonder what you don't want to comment, it's up to you, but whether you think that George is still at heart one of these city elite.
I don't know. I really don't know. But I'm not at all happy at the way he's reacted in this situation. And I'm hugely surprised by it, as all we all are, and very, very disappointed. So there's, you know, not a lot more that I can say than that, really.
Now, look, Trash Horfield, where do people find you on the internet? And if people want to come along and meet you, whereabouts?
If they put Trash Horfield into...
internet search engine, not necessarily Google.
Or any, yes, exactly. So it will come up very quickly. And if they want more information about the wonderful war memorial, then they can put in the Memorial Ground Bristol, and that will come up as well. And I do highly recommend that, because, as I say, a new website's gone up, and it's got some superb photographs on it and a lot of very valuable information. And I think please contact us. That would just be great. The more support and the more people that are wanting to know about what's going on, the better, and who are prepared to, you know, speak up against things which are really not good for the community.
You don't have a phone number, Dinah, but you are on the internet, aren't you? And do you have a website and email address?
Yes, we do, and it's a Trash Horfield website. So anyone putting in Trash Horfield in a search engine will find it.
Okay, it's Trash Horfield, TrashHorfield.
Yes.
.wordpress.com.
.com. That's correct.
And the email address is Rash Horfield. RashOrField. That's RashOrField at gmail.com. So, Dinah Scrafton, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now we go back over 50 years to hear from Aldous Huxley, the author. And we had an original clip from Aldous Huxley 3 or 4 weeks ago. And now we're going to hear a little bit more from him. It's a talk he did in 1962 called The Ultimate Revolution. Now, have you never heard of Aldous Huxley? He is the author of a book called Brave New World, which is often compared to George Orwell's 1984. The difference being that Huxley thought that a new world, a new world order, whatever you want to call it, was going to be something where the people were pacified. Not threatened and bullied, but pacified into agreeing with whatever the government wanted them to do. He talked about it as a kind of scientific dictatorship or technocracy. So let's now join Aldous Huxley, 1962, in his talk, The Ultimate Revolution, and catch up where we left off.
The nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist, to get people actually to love their servitude. This is seems to me, the ultimate in malevolent revolution, shall we say. And this is a problem which has interested me for many years, and about which I wrote 30 years ago a fable, The Brave New World, which is essentially the account of a society making use of all the devices at that time available, and some of the devices which I imagined to be possible, making use of them in order to, first of all, to standardize the population, to iron out inconvenient human differences, to create, so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged in some kind of a scientific caste system. And since then, I have continued to be extremely interested in this problem. And I have noticed with increasing dismay that a number of the predictions which were purely fantastic when I made them 30 years ago have come true or seem in process of coming true, that a number of techniques about which I talked seem to be here already, and that there seems to be a general movement in the direction of this kind of ultimate revolution, this method of control by which people can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which, by any decent standard, they ought not to enjoy. The enjoyment of servitude. Well, this process, as I say, has gone on for over the years, and I become more and more interested in what is happening. And here I would like briefly to compare the parable of Brave New World with another parable which was put forth more recently in George Orwell's book 1984. Orwell wrote his book between 45 and 48, at the time when the Stalinist terror regime was still in full swing, and just after the collapse of the Hitlerian terror regime. And his book, which I admire greatly, it's a book of very great talent and extraordinary ingenuity, shows is, so to say, a projection into the future of the immediate past, of what for him was the immediate past and the immediate present. It was a projection into the future of a society where control was exercised wholly by terrorism and the violent attacks upon the mind body of individuals. Whereas my own book, which was written in 1932, when there was only a mild dictatorship in the form of Mussolini in existence, was not overshadowed by the idea of terrorism, and I was therefore free in a way which Orwell was not free, to think about these other methods of control, these non-violent methods. And I'm inclined to think that the scientific dictatorships of the future, and I think there are going to be scientific dictatorships in many parts of the world, will be probably a good deal nearer to the Brave New World pattern than to the 1984 pattern. They will be a good deal nearer, not because of any humanitarian qualms in the scientific dictators, but simply because the Brave New World pattern is probably a good deal more efficient than the other. That if you can get people to consent to the state of affairs in which they are living, the state of servitude, the state of being, having their differences ironed out and being made amenable to mass production methods on the social level, if you can do this, then you are likely to have a much more stable and much more lasting society, a much more easily controllable society than you would if you were relying wholly on clubs and firing squads and concentration camps. So that my own feeling is that the 1984 picture was tinged, of course, by the immediate past and the present in which Orwell was living, but that the past and present of those years does not represent, I feel, the likely trend of what is going to happen. Needless to say, we shall never get rid of terrorism. This will always find its way to the surface. But I think that insofar as dictators become more and more scientific, more and more concerned with a technically perfectly running society, they will be more and more interested in the kind of techniques which I imagined and described from existing realities in Brave New World. So that it seems to me then that this ultimate revolution is really not very far away, that we already a number of the techniques for bringing about this kind of control are here, and it remains to be seen when and where and by whom they will first be applied in any large scale. And first, let me talk about a little bit about the improvement even in the techniques of terrorism. I think there have been improvements. Pavlov, after all, made some extremely profound observations, both on animals and on human beings. And he found, among other things, that conditioning techniques applied to animals or humans in a state either of psychological or physical stress sank in, so to say, very deeply into the mind-body of the creature, and were extremely difficult to get rid of, that they seem to be embedded more deeply than other forms of conditioning. And this, of course, this fact, I think, was discovered empirically in the past. People did make use of many of these techniques. But the difference between the old empirical intuitive methods and our own methods is the difference between a sort of hit-and-miss craftsman's point of view and the genuinely scientific point of view. I mean, I think there is a real difference between ourselves and, say, the inquisitors of the 16th century. We know much more precisely what we are doing than they knew, and we can extend, because of our theoretical knowledge, we can extend what we are doing over a wider area with a greater assurance of producing something which really works. In this context, I would like to mention the extremely interesting chapters in Dr. William Sargent's Battle for the Mind, where he points out how intuitively some of the great religious teachers, leaders of the past, hit on the Pavlovian method. He speaks specifically of Wesley's method of producing conversions, which were essentially based upon a technique of heightening psychological stress to the limit by talking about hellfire, and so making people extremely vulnerable to suggestion, and then suddenly releasing this stress by offering hopes of heaven. And this is a very interesting chapter of showing how completely, on purely intuitive and empirical grounds, a skilled natural psychologist, as Wesley was, could discover these Pavlovian methods. Well, as I say, we now know the reason why these techniques worked, and there is no doubt at all that we can, if we want to, carry them much further than was possible in the past. And of course, in the recent history of brainwashing, both as applied to prisoners of war and to the lower personnel within the Communist Party in China, we see that the Pavlovian methods have been applied systematically and with extraordinary efficacy. I mean, I think there can be no doubt that by the application of these methods, a very large army of totally devoted people has been created. The conditioning has been driven in, so to say, by a kind of psychological iontophoresis, into the very depth of the people's being, and has got so deep that it's very difficult for it ever to be rooted out. And these methods, I think, are a real refinement on the older methods of terror, because they combine methods of terror with methods of acceptance, method that the person who he is subjected to a form of terroristic stress, but for the purpose of inducing a kind of voluntary, quotes, acceptance of the state and the psychological state into which he has been driven, and the state of affairs within which he finds himself. So that, as I say, there has been, I think, a definite improvement, shall we say, even in the techniques of terrorism. Well, then we come to consideration of other techniques, of non-terroristic techniques for inducing consent and for inducing people to love their servitude. Here, I mean, I think we can, I don't think I can possibly go into all of them because I don't know all of them, but I mean, I can mention a few of the more obvious methods which can now be used and which are based upon recent scientific findings. First of all, there are the methods connected with straight suggestion and hypnosis. I think we know much more about this subject than was known in the past. People, of course, have always known about suggestion, and although they didn't know the word hypnosis, they certainly practiced it in various ways. But we have, I think, a much greater knowledge of the subject than in the past, and we can make use of our knowledge in ways which I think the past was probably never able to make use of it. For example, one of the things we now know for certain is that there is, of course, an enormous, I mean, this has been always known, a very great difference between individuals in regard to their suggestibility. But we now, I think, know pretty clearly the sort of statistical structure of a population in regard to its suggestibility. It's very interesting when you look at the findings in different fields. I mean, in the field of hypnosis, in the field of administering placebos, for example, in the field of general suggestion in states of drowsiness or of light sleep, you will find the same sorts of orders of magnitude continually cropping up. You will find, for example, that the experienced hypnotists will tell one that the number of people, the percentage of people who can be hypnotized with the utmost facility, just like that, is about 20%.
That was Aldous Huxley. The Ultimate Revolution is the talk which he did at Berkeley University in California in 1962, and he's the author of Brave New World. More of that in future weeks. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest. That was Diana Scrafton from Trash Horfield. And studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. Bye.